last week's prologue, I briefly talked about the performance of the American stock market during World War II, and you were probably wondering to yourself, has he lost his mind? What is he talking about? Why is this relevant? Well, in times like these, when no one can figure out what to do with money, all we can do is zoom out and draw on the experience of the past. What great political crises have portended for financial outcomes before. Hey, even the end of the Bretton Woods system, the monetary reset to fiat in 1971, what did it mean, and how can it instruct us in today's crazy times? Well, you won't find answers here, but we will discuss it like the amateurs that we are, as ever. We are not professionals. This is not investment advice. We know not what we do. Please don't listen to us, but please do enjoy Degenerate Business School. What do you do? What does a person do if, as Ray Dalio says, cash is trash because inflation's 8%. So the value of your savings is devaluing at 8% a year. No one's going long on the stock indices because they're just grinding lower. Crypto is in this big, sloppy, sideways pattern, but like not doing great. Although I do want to buy more ETH. I just want it to go lower. I want $1,500 ETH, and then I'm putting the whole house on it, but we're not there yet. So the only place you could be making money over the last, say, 3 weeks is if you were in commodities. Commodities are too complicated. Commodities are for graduate level traders, right?
Or they're like, too volatile. And you knew that like oil was coming back, like no way I'm buying with the price at 110, you know?
Right.
Like doesn't feel like you want to play that game.
And as we always joke, if I'm sniffing around commodities, I'm like, how about this wheat? It means the blow off top has arrived. Sure enough, wheat had a blow off top, although oil hasn't yet. But Jared Dillian made this point that like commodities have V-shaped blow-off tops, and for the most part, like have no discernible pattern. Like you really have to be deep in it to make money in commodities. Whereas like stocks are the opposite; they have V-shaped bottoms. But that was interesting.
Yeah.
Point being, there's nothing for us to do but cry and wait. Patience.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm looking at some of these junky tech stocks that we're buying. You know, like Tiger is at $3 now, and that valuation looks pretty decent. It's like, oh, it's like you know, PE of 14. I'm like, that's actually really reasonable. You know, some of these stocks that we owned or might still have, you know, they're not looking so bad.
Hey, Arc Innovation is like not far from my target price of $40. I think it's at 55. Yeah. Give it another month for tech to unwind some more, and looking pretty tasty. Pretty tasty. So I, having nothing to do, nothing to trade, I decided to go into the historical textbooks, and by that I mean a couple of internet articles, and want to understand. Like what happens to the stock market in a wartime context? Because we're early days, right? Early days in the Ukraine. And this guy on Medium wrote this article about the American stock market during World War II and the German stock market, by the way. And what's interesting is rewind the clock. Started in 1929, you obviously have one of the biggest crashes in global equity history.
But from the early 30s to about 1937 in the American stock market, there was a huge rally. So in my mind, I'm like, interesting, interesting. By the late 30s in the United States, there was actually a sell-off in 1937 that was like idiosyncratic to an American political scandal. And then during the war, the American stock market traded sideways and hit a low point in 1942. And that was basically the apogee of the Axis territorial advance. And then from 1942 to 1945, the American stock market ripped. And conversely, if you look at the German stock market, it was doing great until they invaded Russia. And then after it became clear that they were going to lose the war, it went to zero. It went to zero. So what do we learn? Number one, that humans like we are cynical bastards. And there's so mass psychology at work during World War II, one of the greatest humanitarian calamities ever. People are still trying to make money. So even if it becomes a great power war, as long as it doesn't become a nuclear holocaust, like basically what it tells you is you're it's a call option on who you think is going to win the conflict, right? That's what it tells you.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there was a trade-off, especially back during the 40s, where you have massive government stimulus, FDR, the New Deal, and then with all that wartime spending where we probably amassed like the largest deficits relative to GDP in the country's history. And so real yield, that.
Mm-hmm. Negative real yields.
Yep, yep. Right, it's kind of similar to where we were actually last year. But, you know, I guess the trade-off might be like, okay, you got all this government spending, but are you going to win or not? And then so those things kind of offset each other. Then when it was clear after 42 they were going to win, okay, great. And then opposite side with Germany. And I guess you fast forward to Ukraine here, I think the market got a bid when it looked like maybe Putin might have been backing off. You know, there's like some talks, whatever, little conciliatory statements, but then you're kind of back on track now to like have this being this prolonged quagmire war.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and the other thing it occurred to me, I'm drawing analogies here to these markers. Nothing's perfect, but 1929 is like 2008. And then we have, to your point, New Deal is analogous to, let's say, the American political milieu we're in, where both parties are really into transfer payments, stimulus, you know, basically like giving people cash. That's kind of like the modern incarnation of the New Deal. We have a crisis in 2020, but there's a big policy response. So it's similar in that you have a big rally going into a big crisis. If you know, like 1929 to 1939 is 2008 to say 2022. We're now in the early stages of what could be a great power war. We don't know. So actually what's happening is, given everything we've talked about with the balance sheet support in the US, the American stock market is kind of tepid, but it hasn't fallen apart. Like it's grinding lower. And I think that's a consequence of like, people really don't know what to make of what's happening. So it's in some ways, it's a state of paralysis.
And I think the problem also is that there's really not a catalyst. Like, I mean, back then it could have been government spending. Right now you can't spend, right? We kind of are tapped out with all the stimulus right. From pandemic.
Yeah.
And there's no appetite for it. And then also the tightening, also, you know, reducing the balance sheet. So all that fiscal, monetary, that's sort of going to be on hold for the foreseeable future.
Right.
So tackle inflation. I think, and that's why I think today, to 7.9% CPI, that you know the tech stocks sell off. But that's, I think, the difference this time around is that you got a war and you also got this tightening cycle.
Yes, and politically, all Americans care about is how bad inflation is. They're really upset about it. So to your point, you can't like turn on the. There's no option to turn on the spigot. The Fed's mandate now is to fight inflation. 1941, we were attacked by another sovereign country and we had to go slay the Japanese and the Nazis. So no one cares about inflation in that context, right? They're just going to put those problems on hold. So point being, picking up on what you said too, which is we're kind of at a fragile moment where any really bad news will create a big downside event, where you could be like a sharp correction in equities, or another move higher in commodities. Similarly, tomorrow, Putin signs like a peace treaty with the Ukraine, and there's like a settlement that everyone's fine with, and stocks will rip, and commodities will correct really fast. So we're kind of in this like powder keg moment in terms of like movement, potentially, one way or another.
Yeah, and it's crazy that those polar opposites with the NASDAQ and with commodities. It's just this, you know, everyone's going from one pendulum to the other.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, here's the other thing I want to ask you about. Because you are unofficially the chief economist of this podcast. So other historical analog I'm looking at, that obviously this is all plagiarized, all of this we're talking about from other people. So you have like people on Twitter talking about how we're essentially 50 years into the fiat currency monetary regime of the world. Arguably, it's fiat plus the American petrodollar system, which created the dollar as the reserve currency. Previous to that, from 1945 to 1971, you had Bretton Woods, which was dollars as the reserve currency, but they're pegged to gold. Do you think that we could be in another like monetary reset now, if this is like a prolonged conflict, and we're, even if it's not a hot war, if it's like an escalated cold war with Russia and China on one pole and the United States on another, do you think we're going to see a monetary paradigm shift? I'm not going to ask you to say it's going to be like Bitcoin will be the collateral for the West or whatever, but do you think that this is like a new monetary era?
Well, we've seen, at least right now, the need for an alternative system.
Yeah.
Whether you look at, you know, sanctions of Russia and then China kind of having that sort of faction and you know, being part of SWIFT, whatever. And you also see like confiscation of assets from Canada and that whole trucker riot. So all these things where those decentralized authorities are doing things that are kind of like unilaterally, you know, like really bad, right? And you look at, you know, the opportunity for DeFi, for Bitcoin, for all this decentralized. I mean, you see these use cases, right? And they're just like right there. Like this solves so many problems that people have.
Mm-hmm.
However, really, you don't really see like that everyone rushing to Bitcoin. I don't see everyone rushing to the renminbi. You don't see everyone, you know, so there still is no like real good alternative to the dollar right now. But you do see cracks in like, okay, why do we have this centralized financial system when there's so many things wrong with it? Like, especially that guy, the nickel, the big whale guy from China and you know, the London Metals Exchange kind of unilaterally doing, you know. So you see all this like corruption and issues with like this kind of centralized financial system that we have. And, but again, you don't really have any, and this is like the we've seen for the last couple decades, like, no real alternative to the dollar. Not the euro tried, failed. You know, and the renminbi, it's not open. It's not convertible. So we're still stuck with the dollar and treasuries as the most liquid asset in the world.
Yeah, it would have to be like one thing is, I did pull up what is the price action been in gold over the last 50 years, basically since we went to the fiat era, and it's a logarithmic increase in the price of gold. Although it had a blow off top in the early 80s. This is around the energy crisis of the late 70s. So it's kind of like we went to a floating currency regime, and then we had kind of like a genuine crisis, and gold had like a big run up, and then it actually like didn't do anything until 2008. And then it had like a parabolic run-up. So it kind of tells you, I mean, gold is different for a number of reasons. People have drawn this analogy between like Bitcoin is digital gold. If you have a monetary reset, this is possibly how you could map out the increase in the value of Bitcoin over time. But it does tell you that it's not a straight line, and it kind of depends. It's very context dependent, right? So like someone made this point that there's kind of this like swarm of locusts thing that happens with the modern retail trading crowd, which is part of how we explain the price action in the first half of 2021 is you have an environment where the government's mailing free checks and you have like a mania around crypto and meme stocks, and that mania has died off on the retail side, but they move into other things. So they'll like pile into these commodity trades, and a lot of them will get slaughtered in the process, but it kind of like, to your point, obviously like institutions make the market, but the retail echo effect is like, they're just kind of like chase these rotations. So we're in a period now where like there's no retail demand for Bitcoin. We're in like one of those lulls, but it's supply constrained, and that's the only reason it's not $20,000 right now.
Yeah, I mean, it just Bitcoin just makes too much sense as in the store of value. I mean, it's like I can't carry gold bullion, you know, with me, you know, when times are tough. So yeah, but I guess it's still considered that risk on asset. So, you know, until that whole perception changes, you know, but again, it's like too clear. It makes too much sense that whether it's, you know, Bitcoin for the store of value or, you know, Ethereum for some kind of digital currency.
Well, it is, to your point, like the long arc of why this makes sense, or like in the case of Bitcoin, it's supply constrained, or ETH, like ETH is getting burned, so there's supply constraint put on it. Like the tinder is all laid on the ground, and whatever catalyst comes along will create like positive price action. I have a hot take on Bitcoin, which is, so in order for there to be a monetary reset, you kind of need like the political will to accumulate to make that happen. And you need people in power to be on board with this. And I made this point before in the context of like, who are going to be fund managers in 10 years? Millennials. But who's also going to have political power, assuming the United States is still a thoroughgoing government? It's going to be millennials. And one thing I heard someone say, which I think is actually interesting, is 2022 will be, you kind of already see it, but it will be the first election cycle where Bitcoin or cryptocurrency generally is actually a political, a really core political issue that you have to take a side on, right? And right now it actually seems that like there are people in the Democratic establishment, or not establishment, but in the party that are advocates of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. Like the Biden administration basically issued that document that was in a way supportive, but definitely not anti. And Ted Cruz has bought a lot of Bitcoin, right? So it's actually weirdly it's cross-pollinated both political parties. But if you want to get the vote of a libertarian crypto billionaire who's funding your campaign, you got to be like, Bitcoin is a revolution. You know, you have to say that. And I think that's going to be, that rhetoric is going to show up in 2022, and you would think it would only get bigger, right? And that's just an artifact of demography. So that's why I think like over decades, yeah, it's probably it's time.
If Elizabeth Warren will lose her re-election, he gets hammered because her takes are pretty bad. Yeah, for someone that knows so much about financial markets.
Yeah, but does she? Does she though?
Yeah, like, right? I mean, I think
a lot about the law.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's kind of gone past her professorship into just like, you know, just political pandering, I guess.
Yeah, political theater.
But I mean, I would say that too, if you're going to put your money, and we'll be putting our money into like something that's going to replace the dollar, you know, next couple decades, right? I mean, what are your choices, right? Your choices are, yeah, like the renminbi or like some kind of IMF, like SDRs or, you know, whatever. I mean, Bitcoin, you probably have to put your money on crypto. I would, you know, because really nothing else. I think that has the best possibility of actually being being like replacing treasuries and replacing the dollar as that reserve currency.
Or at least it does in the West. You could have like a, I wouldn't say multipolar. I think it'd be like bipolar, where you have the Atlantic, the legacy Atlantic world, like power structure of Western Europe and North America, led by the United States, is like anchored on Bitcoin as a reserve collateral. Maybe still have like, you could, this is kind of Saylor's point, Michael Saylor, which is you could have Bitcoin as digital gold, digital property, and you still have a central bank digital currency that's the dollar, right? And it's kind of like you only have a few global currencies. It's like the dollar and the renminbi and like maybe the euro, right? Like only three survive. And you could see like the euro collapsing into the dollar. Like there is a world you could imagine where there's like a Western world with crypto and a dollar digital currency, and the East, which is Russia and China, and like trade is nominated in the digital renminbi, and Bitcoin's banned in China. That's a conceivable world we could live in. It doesn't seem like it wouldn't be like stress-free world. It'd be like very antagonistic, but we're deglobalizing, we're regionalizing supply chains. We're kind of settling into this new Cold War, but in the West, crypto clearly has a place. It's too popular.
Yeah, and I think there probably is room for like the dollar, and then that kind of traditional financial market system, and then whatever the Axis powers have like locked themselves out of, whether it's China and Russia, and also China is kind of like their ownership of Africa in a sense, which is going to be like the huge engine. Yeah. In the next few decades. And then you have crypto, which is kind of like, can maybe go over both of those worlds. I know China's like done their ban on crypto, but maybe there is room for it to like span both East and West. And so maybe that's the new regime. That would be the regime, at least for the next 50-100 years.
But it's a good point, like the economic colonialism that China is doing in Africa, which it's like, it's our system that they're replicating. They're using dollars to, enthrall African countries through infrastructure lending. Mm-hmm. But if you're a person living in West Africa or wherever, like you wouldn't necessarily have to opt into the renminbi like monetary system. You could be in the Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, and that would be the, that's like the proxy war, perhaps.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's probably why I would still own my Square shares.
Yeah.
It's like the Jack Dorsey vision of.
Yeah. Totally. All right. Well, so once ETH gets to 1500, I'm going all in. I don't know if it'll get that long.
Yeah. I mean, they're calling it about the crypto winter. I mean, there's like that talk now, right? And so. If it breaks the July lows, then it's like
it is a bit of a miracle that we're not at the July lows. That is encouraging. In a very, very ridiculous way, encouraging. Yes.
Yeah, just kinda like nibble on the way down, and then then once it breaks, if it does break July, that's when you come.
You pile it in. Yeah, yeah.
When you go on in. Yeah.
All right, dog.
Come on.
Good talking.
Good.